Father James, and I'm not sure how to say this, in Rantoul, Illinois. Is that the right way
that's
to pronounce
exactly
that, Father
right.
James?
Yeah, that's right.
Rantoul.
That's right.
I've never heard that. Where's Rantoul?
Rantoul is just north of Champaign-Urbana, Illinois. It's in the center of the state, east central Illinois.
Uh-huh.
We're having a Bible study here. Some people from our parish are at somebody's house in Rantoul having a Bible study, and they're upstairs clapping. I heard there's a delay, but they hear
me. Oh, well, Father James, it makes you and I famous, I guess, huh?
I guess so. At least our 15 minutes here.
Yeah, that's right. Well, it's nice to have you call in, and you serve a Orthodox parish there in Rantoul?
Well, it's in Urbana, Illinois.
Urbana. What's the name of the parish?
St. Nicholas. We're near the University of Illinois here.
Wonderful. Well,
and actually, I just found out tonight there's somebody here in the parish that knows you. But anyway, here's my question.
Okay.
And a parishioner asked me this a few days ago, and I had, you know, my answer for him, but I'd like to hear some more reflection. In the writings of St. John Chrysostom, there are some sentences that are very anti-Semitic. There's no getting around it that he's there's a lot of vitriol in some of his statements. Yet we call him a saint. And could you talk about how we deal with the imperfections of the saints, in particular John Chrysostom and his and what he's accused of being anti-Semitic?
Mm-hmm. You know, of course, anytime we deal with such a luminary like St. John Chrysostom, we have to be careful in our appreciation for him and also our criticism. You know, the Orthodox Church does not raise up any one saint to the level of infallibility, but rather the Church says and often does say that it is the collective witness of the Church Fathers that for us becomes the dogmatic position of the Church.
Right, I agree.
And so there are things within the writings of certain saints that we might find that don't represent the Christian faith in a way that is consistent, let's say, with Holy Scripture and the teachings of the Lord. Now, within the Scriptures itself, as I know you're aware, there's certainly a distinction made between the Jews and the Jewish leadership, and even sometimes what we would call the crowds that are following Jesus. And we know that the Lord reserves his criticism for just the Jewish leadership, not for the Jewish nation. And so the distinction that I think the Church has to be clear about is that distinction between the Jewish leadership and the Jews themselves. And not only do we have to do that as a church, but we have to do that in our careful application of the scriptural witness. And so with St. John, and with any saint, I think St. Basil has a wonderful phrase that I like, but I'm gonna use it in a different way. I don't know if you've heard the idea of whether you're a bumblebee or a fly.
Well, I've heard a little story by St. Paisios about being in a flower garden, right?
Right. So we can go and extract what is good from the flower and take it back to the hive. And I think with St. John, if we're fair, there might be a need to extract certain positions from maybe that wider area of what we would call anti-Semitic comments, or even the notion that we're going against the Jewish people in particular. Would you agree?
Yeah, absolutely. I just wondered if perhaps you or maybe someone else we could refer to at another time has some sense of what the cultural milieu was at the time that brought out that kind of thing and what kind of conflict was going on between the church and the...
I think it's a great question, and there's more to it, certainly more than we can cover tonight on the air. what I think would be great, Father James, if you'll write in your question, there's a priest that I'd love to put the question to. He's sort of a patristic scholar, and we can get his feedback, and maybe that's something we can post on the Orthodoxy Live homepage. So thanks for your call, Father James. Please
All
keep
right.
us in your
that's
prayers, right. and we'll hope to hear from you again soon.
All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. We're going to take our next caller. He's calling in from New Mexico. His name is Andrew. Andrew, welcome to the program.
Hi. Good evening, Father Evan. How are you?
Good. Welcome. Where in New Mexico are you?
Oh, I'm in central New Mexico, and I really appreciate your commitment to taking tough questions. And so I thought I wrote down
appreciate
a tough
it.
Question for you today, and I'm wondering, are you ready for it?
I'm going to do my best.
All right. Well, I recently read Archbishop Demetrius's address to the Clergy-Laity Conference in 2012. I was very concerned to read that the number of marriages performed in the Greek Orthodox Church dropped by 48% over the past 24 years. Likewise, the Church has only budgeted 1% of its budget towards evangelism. This appears to be a demographic disaster. How will the church grow if more and more families choose to worship elsewhere and there is so little resources devoted to bringing converts into the Greek Orthodox Church? In your opinion, what needs to change to stop this cycle of decline?
Well, Andrew, the question is a great one. And I think there's really two questions here. The first is the position of, you know, why is marriage as a sacramental or one of the holy mysteries of the church declining? And the other is about outreach and evangelism. They're connected, but if it's okay, I think I'm going to address them separately. Is that okay?
Okay, sure.
I think on the first question about marriage and its decline, we can look at this as a result of the basic reality of the modern world, isn't it? Marriage is less and less something that people seek out. Now, that doesn't mean that the church, and I think really a lot of this has to do with a loss in membership within the Orthodox Church, but that doesn't mean that the church can't provide clear and concise teaching on the sanctity of marriage and the mystery and the sacrament of marriage. But I think it's we're probably trending in the same way that the American culture is trending. That would be my guess, without doing any research on it. The second part of your question, though, is a little bit more at heart. I think this reality that the church is not invested in outreach and evangelism, that's a good question. And it's one that I think as Orthodox Christians, we've got to have our eye on. You can't really hide from this question. Myself, a little bit of my background, I'm in a mission parish. And so I'm very interested in outreach and evangelism. And I think the Archdiocese is, unfortunately, slowly looking at this issue. You're right. The budget matches up with where your heart is. And if our heart is not into outreach and evangelism, then we're not going to be able to attract people to the faith. We've got to make a commitment to this, not only as a national church, but also in our local parishes. So I basically would agree with you that we need to do more here. And I think you asked, what can we do? Is that right?
That's correct.
Well, fortunately, the Archdiocese holds a national clergy laity, and the laity, along with the clergy, vote for what it is that they want the church to focus on. And I think this is
That's
something
true,
that...
Father, yeah. But it costs so much money to participate in these events. How
I'm
can
with
a family
you.
Of four, you know, even get out to the clergy laity conference when it
sure.
would cost you close to $5,000?
I understand what you're saying, Andrew. I think one of the ways that you can participate is by passing a resolution within your own parish. That's something that people can do, and send that resolution to the floor. I can say within the metropolis of Denver, this has become something, now this is within the Greek Archdiocese, this has become something that we're focusing on. How do we create a strategic plan of outreach and evangelism within our own parishes and within the metropolis as a whole? So I think it's something that the faithful themselves have to take on as an important issue. I'm glad it's coming to the forefront. I think the more we focus on this issue, the more we're going to see results. And I'm optimistic because I have seen within my own parish and within the surrounding parishes a definite growth, both to those who grew up as Orthodox Christians and those who are outside. It's a great question, and I appreciate you asking it.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Andrew. We're gonna take another caller who's on the line. It's David from Williamsburg, Virginia. David, welcome to the program.
Good evening, Father Armitus, and thank you for taking my call, sir.
Well, you're welcome. It's nice to have you on the program with us.
My question is regarding why the Orthodox Church uses leavened bread instead of the unleavened crackers that you would see used in, you know, in the primary Western Christian cultures. There are some that would use leavened bread, but for the most part, they stick with the unleavened. And I was wondering if there was a specific reason for that, whether it be historical, theological, or what it might be.
Well, I think that the main reason for the use of leavened bread in the Orthodox Church has to do with our focus on the resurrection. It's really interesting, David, when you look within the rubrics of the Church, and some people might find looking at rubrics to be a rather boring enterprise, but it's something that I enjoy from time to time taking a second look at. So, for example, the rubrics of the Church stipulate the movements of the priest or even the faithful or the deacon or the bishop during services. And I'm going to answer your question by pointing out a couple of other things. And one of the rubrics of the Church stipulates how the priest receives the Eucharist. So the rubric asks that the priest open his palms, one hand over the other, take a portion of the body of the Lord and place it in his hand before receiving it. Can you see a reason for that?
Not right up front, no.
Not right up front. Well, the Eucharist is a gift. And we receive a gift, we don't take a gift.
Right.
And so the rubric says that the priest must receive the Eucharist. Even though he's serving the Eucharist to himself, he puts it in his hands in such a way that he can receive it. Similarly, the rubric of the Church in using leavened bread, and there's much to say about it, but we'll limit our comments to just this, that the Church looks at the Eucharist not simply as the body and blood of the Lord, but the risen body and blood of the Lord. So a leavened host more accurately reflects the theology of the Church, that it's a risen Lord that we're receiving. One other rubric that sort of makes this point is right before the serving of communion, hot water is placed into the blood so that the blood is served warm because we partake of a living and risen Lord. It's a good question, and I hope the answer helps.
Oh, yes, the answer does help, and it makes complete sense because it seems that the focal point has always been on the death and burial,
right,
instead of on the resurrection, as you're saying, and that makes much more sense because then that would basically negate anyone saying, well, you're re-sacrificing Christ.
Correct.
It's a re-sacrifice. It's not a re-sacrifice at all in the way that you explained it. So that makes much more sense.
Well, thanks for your call, David. I appreciate it, and I hope you'll call again. Once
Thank
again,
you,
you're welcome. Once again, we want to remind you of the number you can call in. It's